making good. I'm Renee Blanchard, founder and operator of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery, located here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Church Alley is a people-first, mission-driven small business that I opened in 2013. And the best part about owning a cafe is the people. So in this podcast, I interview the makers, the farmers, and the many interesting people I've met through the shops, the folks doing the good work here in Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm Beth Sloan. I'm a registered dietitian and an assistant professor of dietetics at Nicholls State University in Thibodaux. I've been a registered dietitian since 1991 and have a big interest in community. I worked for the WIC program for Louisiana for about 10 years and really enjoy working with food insecurity and making sure that people don't go hungry. So I'm currently in a doctoral program where food insecurity on college campuses is the focus of my dissertation. So,
great. Well, thank you so much for being here. So you're my professor. I have most of my classes with you. So, but I'm happy to have you here and just to talk about food insecurity. And specifically this past semester, one of our classes went into depth on the WIC and SNAP programs that I thought was really interesting. I really appreciated those assignments and learning more. I didn't know anything about WIC or SNAP. I know, or very little about it at all. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to kind of dig into the changes that are happening right now. And then we also had an assignment where we had to go and observe a WIC go into the office. So that was really interesting. But can you just explain what is WIC? What exactly is this program?
So WIC stands for Women, Infants, and Children. And the program was initiated in the early 1970s because breastfeeding rates had started to decline. Infants were being born low birth weight, premature, and we had a lot of malnutrition, especially anemia in young children, preschool age children. So the program was initiated, and so currently it provides pregnant women, postpartum women, infants up to a year, and children up to 5 years of age with a food package where the foods are determined specifically to target nutrients that are lacking in the diets of that population. The program not only provides foods or infant formula, but they also provide breast pumps to women who are breastfeeding, nutrition education. We do some screenings and lots of referrals to other agencies, whether they're federal agencies or state agencies for assistance. And so that's kind of just a big summary of the WIC program.
Yeah. So it was really interesting. I didn't understand that the health screening, I felt like that for me, witnessing the health screening was such an interesting and important part of the program itself. So the participants come every 3 months to regain cash on a card, basically, right?
Their benefits,
to purchase the items that are the nutrient focus of the population. And then they get a brief health screening. They can talk about, they have a registered dietitian that they talk to, and then they're asked how they're doing and what health, that is transformative. That is just a huge benefit to young families and young mothers. Healthcare access is just so hard to come by. And so I just feel like that is just unbelievable. I just didn't understand.
Right. And WIC has changed over the last, so I've been gone from WIC for 11 years. And so there's been a lot of changes in the past 11 years. But from even when I started with working for the state with WIC in 2002, and when I left in 2012, there were a lot of changes that happened there, especially in those health screenings. So WIC is a federal program where the monies go down to the states. And so the states can then have freedom to operate the program as they see fit. So in some states, some areas, WIC is administered in a lot of pediatric offices. And so the people work in the pediatrician's offices, and the kids come in, and it's really good there because they're seeing the patients are being seen by WIC nurses or dietitians, and having these screenings, and then they can, if they see a problem, well, the physician is right there, and so they can refer them. Other places, it's done through public health units. And so in Louisiana, we have several public health units around the state. Almost every parish has at least one public health unit. And in the old days, I'll say, the public health units were where people that were uninsured or underinsured went for health care. That model is now changing. And so because of Medicaid and the changes in Medicaid and how that's handled, more and more of the basic health care things have moved out of the health units and into the private sector. So the WIC program that's in the health units plays a vital role in helping to accomplish some of these screenings, because in some of the rural areas in North Louisiana, the health unit is their first line of defense. And so they go there, they can get their immunizations there, and the WIC program is screening them for anemia. They're screening them for infants and children for failure to thrive, that their growth is plateaued, that they have other issues. They talk to the mom. So is a pregnant woman not gaining enough weight? Is she showing postpartum signs of depression? So that they can make those referrals. So the public health units can serve a really important part in some of those screenings. And a lot of people don't realize that some of those screenings are being done in the WIC program.
Yeah. What do you think are some, I mean, can you maybe explain a little bit about what the community-wide benefits are of a WIC program in their parish? Like,
well, I think, number one, it's a resource for women who are pregnant and don't have a lot of information. And so maybe they they have insurance or they don't have insurance, but WIC in the health unit can get them connected to a Medicaid provider and get them enrolled in Medicaid. So that would be number one. So no pregnant woman in Louisiana should be uninsured. Medicaid is there, and there are programs for that. So that would be number one, to make sure that from a community standpoint, we're taking care of pregnant women. We're making sure that they're gaining the appropriate amount of weight, that if they're smoking, we try, there are state programs to help pregnant women stop smoking. If they have another illness, chronic illness, say high blood pressure, we can screen them, because if they complain that we have nurses in the health unit, they can check their blood pressure. Mm-hmm. They're being screened for anemia. So from a community standpoint, we're helping these pregnant women, which in turn helps them have infants who are born healthy. They're mm-hmm. born at the appropriate gestational time period, and that they're born at a healthy weight. From that standpoint, you can look at it as healthy infants and pregnancies are good for the community, meaning we're not going to, you know, if you want to look at dollars for dollars, you're saving money in Medicaid on an infant who is healthy and born healthy, and a mom, versus an infant who is born premature or a low birth weight that has to spend a few days in the NICU, and those monies are being spent. Now, they're money that's being spent for a good reason, but if you're saving money by having healthy babies, then that money, that pool of money in Medicaid, can be spent on something else that's needed. So they're doing that. They're checking children, preschool children, so they're being seen up to 5 years of age, so that would be when they would start kindergarten. And so if the children are brought into the clinic, they're being weighed and measured. They're having their blood checked for anemia, but the screening questionnaire is also going to, and if you look at a child and you can talk to a child, is their speech appropriate? Do they have any swallowing difficulties? Are they, does the mom mention anything else that maybe they would feel more comfortable talking to the WIC staff about, rather than a physician? And so if they can communicate that the child is having some difficulties, then the WIC staff can then refer them on and tell them, these are some of the things that you need to be cautious about, and this is how you can get this taken care of. So I think that it helps, that the program helps the community by keeping these kids healthy and their moms, and taking care of the moms too.
Yeah. And what are the challenges for accessing WIC? I mean, one thing may be awareness that people can go to these, mm-hmm. and that it's free and you can sign up and you can talk to someone. Are there any other challenges that you think for accessing?
I would say in some areas of the state, it would be transportation might be an issue. So in the cities, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Lafayette, Shreveport, all of those larger cities, there are multiple clinics that someone can access, whether it's by public transportation or their personal. But in some of the rural areas, that can be a burden for them, depending upon how far away they live. The program is free. You do have to show proof of identity. So somebody would have to have something that, and there's a list, there's a long list of things. So you don't have to have a driver's license or a state issued ID, but there's things. But for some people, that could be a barrier or a challenge. They don't have to have a referral to come into WIC. If it's a woman who's pregnant, she's taken a home pregnancy test, we can accept a home pregnancy test. So she'll, if they can do a pregnancy test in some of the health units, but if she goes to one where they don't do that, or they go to a WIC clinic that's located at a pediatrician's office, they may not have that availability. So they'll have to refer them to get a pregnancy test and then come back with that Varicate. So that could be an issue for some women. Unfortunately, like I used to see women coming in to get certified for WIC and they're 36 weeks pregnant. Not 36 months, but they're about ready to have the baby. And why didn't you come in, 6 months ago? And they think, oh, well, I just wanted it for my baby. And I thought I had to come in now. And so we really try to reach out and say, no, we want you to come in as soon as you find out that you're pregnant, so that we can make sure that you're getting prenatal care, and that if you don't have insurance, that we can get you signed up for Medicaid.
Yeah.
So sometimes those are the barriers. Having to bring children into the clinic is sometimes that's an issue if they're in a like a preschool or pre-K-3 program or 4. So the federal government who writes the rules and regulations for WIC does realize that that can be a problem. And so there are ways around that. So they do have provisions for, you don't have to bring the child in every 3 months or every 6 months. If they've seen the pediatrician recently, then they can bring that paperwork in. So, but when I was working there, and that was one of the major issues with having to bring the kids in.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that's, I witnessed a couple interviews where there were kids and it was difficult to, well, I mean, I guess it's both ways. It was difficult to have the kids there as well as it was probably to get them there. The same.
Right.
So the other food insecurity program we have is SNAP. And that's just supplemental nutrition for people who may, I mean, you can describe it better, who are, well, most of the people are having or have their hours cut, or it's very low wage, they need extra food, or they're disabled or children or elderly, homeless, and SNAP. And SNAP specifically has been in the news. It's often used as a tool for political gain during budget conversations. And that's what also recently happened.
Right.
Kind of, they wanted to cut it in order, you know, to or have more working requirements, but it's specifically in the farm bill. And that is what gets renewed every few years. I don't know. I think it's like 5 years or something.
Every 5 years, yeah.
Can you just talk about exactly what SNAP is and maybe why it's kind of used like that sometimes in those conversations?
Well, SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So they modernized the name several years ago from food stamps. Right. So the difference between SNAP and WIC is that SNAP is a hunger prevention program, whereas WIC is a nutrition program. And so there was a lot of blowback when they renamed it Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, because of there's really no restrictions on the kinds of foods that you can buy with SNAP. So you can buy things that are maybe people deem not nutritious things or junk foods and things with very low nutritional value. So whereas WIC, it's a food benefit program. So it's not a dollar amount. So they get so many gallons of milk, a dozen of eggs, 36 ounces of cereal. So it's very specific. Whereas SNAP is a dollar amount. So a family may get, I don't know, $400 of benefit, and then they can spend that benefit at the supermarket or corner stores, grocery stores, Dollar Generals, things like that, on things that food products that they need. So SNAP is considered an entitlement program, whereas WIC is not. WIC is in the discretionary budgeting. So WIC is, you know, funded based upon how many participants, but it's not guaranteed that it would get the funding for that amount of participants. Okay. So they have to decide on that. Whereas SNAP, because it's in that entitlement program, the money for SNAP is then allocated based upon the participation. So let's just say that there's 10 million people nationwide that qualify for SNAP. Well, then the federal government has to provide the funding for those participants. And so entitlement programs like SNAP, Social Security, Medicare, those kinds of things are always the ones that that draw a big attention because of the way that they're funded. And so how can we cut entitlements? And that's always a big political issue. The SNAP is one of the probably the easier things to cut as far as monies and looking at, okay, so how are people being qualified? Are they doing are they working at all? How many hours are they working? Those kinds of things. And so there's a lot more, people are a little, I don't know how to say it, but it's an easy target, I guess, to look to make some cuts.
We often put morality on top of poverty or circumstance.
Right. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that there's no fraud in any of these programs, because we know that there is. But maybe it's my naivete, and I think that most people are honest and they go there because they have a need. So what a lot of people think is that, you know, the SNAP is supplemental assistance. So it's not meant to provide a 100% of the food that a family would need in a month. Now, for people who are very thrifty and can manage their food budgets and they're managing it appropriately and being really aware of what they're buying, they can pretty much do a really good job of managing their SNAP budget. Food costs fluctuate, and we've seen that inflation in the past couple couple of years where food costs have significantly increased. And so that does play a part. So I'm not sure if I really answered your question with that or not.
Yeah, I think so. Then we also have, so part of the new things that they went through just this last month, I guess June, was new work requirements for 50 to 54 year old people. But then there's exceptions, like no veteran has to have different requirements. If you're homeless, you don't have. And if you're 18 to 24 and aged out of foster care, so that's an exemption as well. Like you don't have as much restrict requirements. But I was reading that, yeah, 2/3 of the people on SNAP are children, elderly, and disabled people. And that it really is only with like 3 months till 2 years that people are really kind of using those types of services.
Yeah, SNAP was, I mean, any type of federal, in my opinion, SNAP is not meant for to be for your life. It was meant for to help people and to bridge a gap and to help them get through a time period. So if you were out of work, if you were temporarily, you had a short-term disability and you couldn't make ends meet, that was that it's there for those reasons. And it provides a good benefit for people. And so, you know, for me, I can't stand the thought that somebody is hungry.
Yeah.
It's truly upsetting to me in this country that people go hungry. And so that's why I have this this issue with we need to look at these benefits and make sure that they're getting to the people who need them, but I don't see why it's always such a big political issue. Yeah. one way or the other.
Right. And we've seen just with COVID, we've seen how quickly something can happen to someone or to someone,
right.
and the need is so high. I mean, we have in New Orleans, I think we've seen it everywhere, but we have these community fridges all over now because we have such our population, we have industry that is so high and low, you know, we have houses, mostly what we work on. So tourists come in sometimes and sometimes they don't, you know, like right now they're not really here. So the need is greater at certain points.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. And I was reading that for Louisiana, this is from Feeding America. They said that SNAP, there's $1.2 billion put into SNAP in Louisiana and the economic activity is over $2 billion for the community, for the state. So there's like a more than double economic return on benefits going into SNAP.
So are they looking at the money that's being distributed in benefits that the economy is seeing a double?
Yeah. So yeah, I guess you go in with SNAP and you buy a few things, but then you're buying other stuff.
Right. Exactly. So it brings people into the store because there are several things. I mean, you can only buy food with SNAP, or you can buy seeds or plants to grow food. So you can't buy pet food. You can't buy alcohol. You can't buy cleaning products, hygiene products, things like that. So if you go into the store, you're using your SNAP dollars. But if you also need toilet paper and Kleenex, you're going to pick that up too. And so you can, that would be a cash transaction. So I think that from an economic standpoint, it helps the businesses because you see so many more Dollar Generals that are Family Dollar that accept the SNAP benefits now. It's not just supermarkets. So those little stores are popping up in areas where more rural areas, more urban areas where supermarkets are further apart. And so then they have a place to go to utilize their benefits, and then they're going to pick up other things.
Yeah. I mean, in the economics of a grocery store is really complicated. You really can't put a grocery store in a lot of places, like when you look at how to stay open. And we've seen that in New Orleans after the Katrina, with supermarkets tried to come into spots and they just couldn't survive in a lot of
right. places.
So they're mm-hmm. a little more concentrated. And food security in Louisiana is really high. It's quite high compared to other states. It's like 1 in 5 children live in poverty, or if food insecure, 24% of children live in poverty in the in Louisiana alone. 1 in 7 of all people are food insecure. That's very high.
And we're not the highest in the nation either.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
right.
So there are other states, especially, I would say off the top of my head, I would think that the West, when you're looking at parts of Arizona, Nevada, that have and Native American reservations, those are areas of poverty. Places in the Appalachian Mountain right. area have pockets of poverty, and so sometimes those areas have higher numbers. But we are the southern region as a whole usually has the highest levels of food insecurity in the nation when you're looking at the different geographical regions.
Yeah. And I saw Feeding America too. They said that there was a food shortage, so like the dollars needed to bridge the gap between food insecurity and being food stable is like over $400 million each year in Louisiana.
So that would be the gap between how much money is provided through SNAP versus actual food costs for a family. And so there's that gap. So that's where food banks can come in. Commodity programs, which is another USDA food program, can help bridge that gap. But a lot of times it's the food pantries, food banks that are helping to bridge that gap for people.
Like in churches, not just like a Second Harvest or something like
that. Oh, right. You know, you think like my church here in my neighborhood, they have a food pantry. And so I can't remember. They ask for donations like every couple of times a month. They'll ask you to bring some non-perishable foods to Mass, and if you need assistance, you call the church office, and they can give them out. They also have around Christmas time where they ask people to donate gift cards to the grocery or to Walmart. So I think that there's churches, there are other nonprofits. There's a local family who own car dealerships, and he has Hope for NOLA? He has a large warehouse in New Orleans East next to one of his car dealerships. And he has a very large food distribution that he partners with other nonprofits and Second Harvest, and they distribute food, but they also cook food and they distribute meals. And so for a lot of people who are homeless or who are living in substandard conditions, having a hot meal sometimes is preferable to receiving a box of non-perishable foods if they have no way to cook it.
Yeah.
So they're reaching out into that area as well.
Yeah, that was one of the things we discussed in our WIC assignment, was that they were changing the meals, the ways, like frozen, fresh types of meals, so that, because, you know, we don't all have access to stoves or whatever, or we don't always have, a lot of people in New Orleans don't always have electricity.
Right.
Fact that, you know, what one, whether you have money or not, our electricity is an issue here, but a lot of families do not have enough money to have to keep electricity on a regular basis here.
Right. And then you have the issue of if you are renting, that you're at the mercy of your landlord to repair a stove or to get a new refrigerator or to repair your oven or to fix a leak in your sink. And so I was working in Slidell one time and a client came in and she wanted ready to feed infant formula. And it was because she didn't have a working stove in order for her to sterilize the water and the bottles and things for the baby. So you don't think that in Slidell, there's going to be someone who doesn't have that. I think a lot of people's eyes were opened after Katrina when people were living in these, the famous FEMA trailers. And, right. And so their storage capacity had drastically decreased. So instead of having a regular size refrigerator, you have this little teeny tiny one, and we're giving 8 gallons of milk a month. And so what are you going to do with that? So in the old program, we had figured out a way to do that. With the new, with the benefit card that WIC has, your benefits are loaded on the card. And then you can go to the, if you want to go to the grocery every day, you can get a gallon of milk, you can get a loaf of bread. Then the next day you could go and get your cereal and then you can get your eggs. So it doesn't matter. It's not an all or nothing like it used to be. So for people, that can be a tremendous benefit, especially if they're shopping at smaller stores, and so they don't have as big a variety, or that they're using public transportation, and who wants to go on a bus with 3 bags of groceries? So that's being able to use the EBT cards, and it's a chip, and so you can get one thing at a time if that's how you want to use your benefits. That's a plus. I see it as that. But I think that there are a lot of people out there who they're falling in that gap and they need that temporary assistance to get them through the month.
And the flexibility.
The flexibility, right, yeah.
So another thing that we that you're studying as well is college campus food insecurity. And that's something we talked a little bit about because Nichols does have two or three different programs to help our students. But can you talk about and I remember I'm in college now, but it's different because now I'm a middle-aged woman in college and have all this other stuff. But when I, 25 years ago, yeah, but I worked and it was very difficult. There wasn't a lot of, I didn't make a lot of money, but I did have my parents at the end of the day, but that's not really the case all the time. Can you just talk about how big is the issue of food insecurity on college campuses for young people right now?
It's bigger than what a lot of people actually have any idea about. And so some states, the number of college students who are food insecure is higher than the state average or higher than the national average. And a lot of it is that there's a lot of reasons. So you might have someone who is going back to school we would consider them a non-traditional student. So they're going back to school at an older age. They might have a family. They might not have a family. They might be working, but they're having to pay tuition. And so that's an extra expense that they have to cut someplace. And so maybe that's their grocery budget is being cut to be able to afford that. You have people, because we have financial assistance, we have Pell Grants, we have student loans, but tuition and fee costs have increased over the past 20 years so much that it might not be enough. And so they get the maximum amount of student loan, but it's still not enough to help pay their living expenses. Excuse me. So if they're not commuting, they don't live at home and they're not commuting back and forth to school, they're going to live on campus, they're going to live in an apartment, they're going to borrow enough money to pay their utilities and pay their rent and pay gas and tuition. But they don't really look at those extra things like food. And so that's not calculated into their budget. So then they're running low because they don't have enough money to spend on food. Then you have students that are first generation college students. So they're the first in their family. And so they may be coming from a lower socioeconomic group. They may not, but they don't have the, they may be coming from a family. In some of my research, one of the researchers, they call it a pipeline approach. So you have a family that is on a lower socioeconomic status. So they are, their income is not to the median average. And the, because of that, the kids are getting free or reduced price lunch in school all the way K through 12. They're getting that. The family may get extra benefits. They may get some SNAP. They may not, but let's just say they get free and reduced price lunch. So that's a benefit that the family doesn't have to worry about paying for lunch for those one or two or three or four kids out of their grocery money. And if they qualify for breakfast, that's another meal. Well, what happens to those kids when they graduate from high school? Does the financial need all of a sudden change? No. So that 18-year-old who was getting free or reduced price lunch in high school is now on their own in college. Even if they're still living at home, okay, so that's, they're not getting a free meals now. So the family has to pay for that, or the student has to pay for that. So there are a lot of kids who are in that situation, and there's no assistance for them at that age to get free meals or free groceries or anything like that. And so that's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Mm-hmm. So what do you do for those kids? Well, you know, can you afford a meal plan? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe I can only afford the minimal meal plan, which provides like two meals, or it's 10 meals a week. Okay, well, then what do you do with the other meals, and what do you do on the weekend, especially if you live in a residence hall? So I think a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I remember when I was in college in the 80s and, you know, we, you know, didn't have a whole lot of money. Well, maybe, but things are more expensive now. And so you have to have a computer, you have to have an iPad, you have to have a cell phone, you have to have computer access. All of these things are more expensive now. Textbooks are out of sight. So sometimes something has to give. And so that there's this large amount, this large population of students who unfortunately are in that gap, and they're hungry. So college campuses have really seen that need and have started that process of trying to be able to mend that gap or bridge that gap for them.
And Louisiana just passed that law, or not a law, but I guess it's a way to help alleviate or help encourage college campuses to make their campus a non-hunger zone.
Right.
To provide as many services as possible.
Correct. And so in order for the college campuses in Louisiana to get this designation as a hunger-free campus, is that they have to have some type of food pantry. They have to have an event once a year to bring awareness to food insecurity on campus. And they have to have a way to refer students who are in need to other community resources. Like, this is what we have available on our campus, but then what's in the community that we can refer you to if you need additional assistance?
We used to have, the first time I went to college, we had, I can't remember what it, the name of it now, it's like the Hunger Dinner or something like that, where we would have a full dinner for, it would be like 200 people, students and faculty, and then throughout that would be an experience, though, like you would be randomly divided up and lose your dinner or lose your place, and you would have to go somewhere else where you didn't have much, or then you would, and it would the situation would just mimic like life experiences, like things that happen that can, like, just to kind of show how fragile our places, you know, our resources are on our everyday. It was interesting.
Right. And then, you know, some of my research is showing where a lot of the research gaps are. So there's a lot of research out there that talks about K through 12 and that you need to feed students in order for their brains to work, for them to pay attention in school, for their grades to improve. But it stops at that level. So there's really not a lot of research out there that shows the level of hunger in a college student and the reflection of their grade point average or the amount of studying and things like that. And I think that that's something that needs to be attention needs to be brought to that. Well, I think it's that you just don't think about it because they're adults and, well, you have the ability to go and buy something to eat. Whereas if you're six, you're relying on somebody to provide you with a meal or something to eat. But if you don't have the funds to go and buy something, what are you going to do? And so if you're hungry, how much does it preoccupy you? Are you able to concentrate? Are you able to, does it impede in your social life because your friends are going out to eat and you don't have the money to do that? So, you know, there's a social aspect to that.
Yeah. And then also, like, literally your brain isn't developed until you're 24, 25 years old. So there are some physical things. Males are still growing. They haven't stopped growing at 18.
Right.
And then also athletes. A lot of students are dependent on their scholarships. And there are excess nutritional needs involved in being able to keep going to school.
Right, right. And then a lot of times scholarships will only pay for the tuition. Right. They don't pay the fees. And so when you look at your college, at your fee bill, there's a line for tuition and how much that costs per credit hour. And then there's a whole list of fees that are attached to that. So some scholarships will not pay the fees. And then you're left with, okay, well, I'm maxed out on my federal, you know, subsidized student loans. So then you have to go to unsubsidized loans, which I think those are the ones where you have to pay the interest during the time. It's not deferred. So that's another expense for people if they're doing something like that. So there's a lot of issues with college students that people don't seem to really be aware of. So I'm happy with what Nichols is doing and some of the changes, improvements that they're making in their food insecurity or their food security, if you want to call it, and some of the things that they're doing.
Yeah, it seems pretty good. The closet, well, there's Mom's Pantry that we have on campus, which is small, and an outside group that runs that. And then there's the closet in one of the residence hall that is pretty big. It's not
right. And I was just in there day before yesterday, and they have installed another pantry outside. Right outside, and it's covered. It's in that alcove out there. So that's going to be another 24/7 comes, you know, help yourself to food availability. And the closet is now partnering with Second Harvest Food Bank to get foods and donations in there. They have a refrigerator in there, and they had a lot of things in there. They had juice. They had cold cuts. They had those little fruit, you know, little squeezy things that to me, it looks like baby food. It's like applesauce and things like that. They had a bunch of those in there. And so we have a freezer. So I told them that if they needed a freezer, we had a freezer that we could donate to them. So hopefully their partnership with Second Harvest will see continued improvements in that.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, that's all the questions I have. I just wanted to kind of do a big overview of all the things. I guess this is the class. This is basically the class we just took.
But I find that I really like to know what the community is doing, because I think that there are the government assistance, whether it's through WIC or whether it's through SNAP, only can go so far. So to see things that are being done by community leaders or people like you who are helping with the with the refrigerators or community refrigerators, gardening projects, things like that, to me are really interesting. And how do we bring awareness to that and bring funding to that? I guess it would be probably through grant writing and stuff that you would have to look for that kind of thing. But I think that that's really important, because people help people, and sometimes that's what you need. You can't always rely on government to help.
No, and I think we know that. You know, the Gulf Coast knows that almost more than most places, right? Like,
right.
These federal governments are great, but when things go terribly wrong, they can't get here. You know,
right.
It really is up to us. You know, you think about Ida, just the most recently, when Bell Edwards was like, "We can't not get to you. It's very likely we will not get to you for 3 days." Right? That is the earliest that anyone will be able to get to you if the worst happens in your neighborhood. So,
right.
Prepared. And that's just true, right? That's true for escalating climate change impacts. That is true for an unstable economy that we're seeing now. What's happening with schools and student loans and all of that kind of the debt escalation of our communities and our neighborhoods. We are reliant on one another. That's just
right.
Bottom line.
And I think that you see that with as much unrest sometimes that there is in the country, that when something happens in the community, they pull to you, the community pulls together. And so I'm a true believer in that neighbors will help each other. And that's kind of like how that Cajun Navy started with they went out. I think it was during Harvey, the big flooding that they had around Baton Rouge, and trying to get to people. So that I think that kind of grassroots movement is so needed, and it fills that area of where, we can't get to you in three days, but your guy down the street's got a little flatboat with a motor, and he's going to come and help you, or, you know, so... I think that that's an important thing. So to see people in the community that are trying to help one another, I think that that's a really great thing.
You think about it's so hard a lot of times to live in Louisiana, right? Especially to live in South Louisiana, New Orleans, these neighborhoods. But we have so much knowledge to share with the rest of the country because it has over generations continued to survive. Like our communities and our cultures continue to survive against all odds. And it's that we sit outside all day long, you know, and talk to people and like build what we need for one another.
Well, and I think that there's also that we still have that connection to the earth, to, you know, hunting and fishing and gardening and things like that. I have always said, if the world's coming to an end, I'm going down the bayou because they know how to survive and they can teach me a bunch of things. So that's where you want to go, because we have gone through a lot, and the city is not where you want to be in some kind of big disaster.
I get my Cajun, hopefully some Cajun ancestral will come to me when I need it.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and talking and with me and today. Well, that's all for today. Thanks so much for listening to Making Good. You can find our podcast on all the platforms you find your favorite podcasts. You can also find a transcript of this episode and all of our episodes on our website, churchalley.store. If you loved this episode, please share it and let others know about the good work of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery. Thanks again for listening to Making Good. I hope you have a really good day. We'll see you next time.